It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, a lot of people have embraced the outdoors this summer, and that includes camping. We'll hear from two Wisconsin campground hosts about life in the state parks this year. First, all eyes are on the researchers and scientists working to develop a vaccine for COVID-19. But once a hypothetical vaccine is approved and ready to go, there's a lot more to consider, like who gets it first and why. Our next guest is an expert in bioethics and is here for a look at potential coronavirus vaccine distribution plans. Arthur Kaplan is a professor of bioethics in the Division of Medical Ethics at the New York University Grossman School of Medicine. His books include Vaccination, Ethics, and Policy. Art, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Well, let's start off with the basics of the problem here. Even if there's a vaccine, it's tested and approved, it doesn't instantly become available to everyone at once, right? There's going to be, at least initially, some kind of bottleneck.
That's right. And we're hearing people throw out dates like vaccine by October 28th. I don't think anything will be in anybody's arm by then. And the reason is, even if FDA approves something, even if it approves it based on early data, you still have to make it, you still have to ship it. And those are big challenges to getting vaccine out all around the country. Again, even if we're not going to try and vaccinate 330 million of us right away, if some people are going to go first, these are two-shot vaccines. They have to be refrigerated. They require vials and needles and training of people to how to give the shots. So that takes time, and that's why I find it almost silly to talk about dates like the end of October.
Now, when it comes to this decision of who gets it first, I've seen advisory panels and recommendations, but is there an entity in the United States that makes the decision, yeah, this group gets this vaccine first?
There is. Traditionally, it's been the Centers for Disease Control has a committee called the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. They're the ones who say that vaccine is approved and ready to go. I have to tell you, most of their work has been involved with kids, not adults, and we're talking about adult vaccines here. But nonetheless, that's the group. FDA can approve something and say it's ready to go. The data is good, it looks safe, it looks effective enough, but it's the CDC advisory group that actually gets into distribution.
What kind of factors go into the decision of who gets a vaccine like this first?
Well, for that one, I'm going to say we'll need the next 7 hours. It's a long, complicated thing, but to boil it down, it goes something like this. How effective is this vaccine? If it's 50% effective, that's really enough to start to get you some herd immunity, meaning the virus will have a hard time jumping from one person to the next. If it's less than that, it might give you a little protection, but it's probably most people would not be interested in it. It just wouldn't make you safe enough. So part of the decision is how safe, how effective does it have to be before we give it to anybody? But if we're looking at a line of people who might want to take a vaccine first, I think you're probably going to go to the people who are at high risk of getting very sick or dying from COVID. So one group is the healthcare workforce. They're exposed. A lot of the frontline workers who deal with COVID patients in ICUs and ERs, they're going to be highly eligible. People work in nursing homes around the elderly who frequently get infected, and maybe the elderly themselves. So I would say your highest risk people, probably in the healthcare side of the street, because you want to keep that system running.
There have also been concerns about, okay, people who are maybe not in healthcare, but are at points of contact where the disease could spread. They may not be high risk for the damage of COVID-19, but they might work with a lot of people, maybe in a school, a retail establishment, wherever. Is that part of the consideration? Are there people we can focus on to break the threat of transmission?
Yeah, that's the second consideration. After you handle the highest risk and get involved with the prevention of death and disability, then you're going to move to spread. And that might be daycare, schools, people who are in transportation, like train conductor, airline steward, stewardess, that kind of thing. People who come into high contact. Those could be if you will, places where spread occurs more rapidly. I'm tempted to add in bartenders and waitresses and other people who deal with the public in a big way. But first, I think you've got to take care of your immediately at risk of dying. And by the way, let me add this. Healthcare workers sounds great. Healthcare workers need, for a functioning hospital, not just doctors and nurses, they need people to clean the room, do the laundry, make the food, provide the security, do the IT so they can keep track of records, have the labs. It's a big, big group. I'm going to predict that even if we said healthcare workers first, we're not going to be able to do all of them first. We're going to have to make decisions within that group.
We're talking to bioethicist Art Kaplan from New York University, looking at a hypothetical COVID-19 vaccine and how decisions are made about who gets it first if it's an effective vaccine. You could join him with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. Art, let's talk about geography. Is there a consideration of, okay, this is a hotspot, whatever region of the country is a hotspot when this thing comes out, we need to get our resources there first. Or this is a densely populated area that might be at risk next. How do we sort out where geographically the vaccine goes?
Yeah, it's a good question, because I think what you're going to see is balancing where is the virus in a big outbreak. That's where the healthcare workforce, I think, will get it first. Other healthcare workers and nursing home workers in places where things are quiet, say right now New York City or Connecticut where I am, may not be first. They may go to Florida, Arizona, or Texas. People may get their backs up a little bit because they may say, well, those places are hotspots because either they opened up colleges or they didn't wear masks or they didn't social distance and other places did better. But nonetheless, you're not going to see a fight about guilt. I think what you're going to see is a battle to try and protect people at the greatest risk, and the healthcare workers are not at fault in those places. One other factor, shipping. So you got to refrigerate these vaccines. And remember, they take two shots, most of them, not all, but most. So you got to truck them somewhere. Some of them require special refrigeration. So if you don't have that in a rural area, if you don't have that actually, well, whatever it is, you may not see the vaccine headed that way because you can't store it.
How much does politics come in here? If I'm a member of a congressional delegation from a state that's, you know, in the lower priority list, I'm not going to be happy about that. I might want to raise a stake. If I'm in that rural area, I might be asking the government to go the extra mile to get me those, I don't know, refrigerated trucks or whatever it's going to take. Do you see a lot of political debate about something like this?
Yeah, inevitably. I mean, I think we'll see a bit of a black market with the rich saying, I want to get access, and we may see special clinics saying, I can get this for you if you have X amount of dollars. We're going to set up something where, you know, you pay us $20,000 and we'll get you the vaccine. I can see panic leading to that sort of thing. I can see fights, regional and otherwise, breaking out. Remember, too, there's another group that's going to weigh in here and get access, and that's the military. Remember we had breakouts on, like, aircraft carriers and some of those ships a while back? Some of the commanders got fired for complaining that they weren't getting a rapid enough response for COVID outbreaks on their warships. Well, the Department of Defense isn't going to put up with that, and I'm sure they're going to step in and say, we don't care what the rules are and so forth. We are protecting those people in the military, and I think they're going to take part of the initial supply, too.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Becky is with us in Beloit. Becky, hi.
Hi. I was just wondering what the thoughts are on home health workers or hospice workers, people who might not be part of a great big company. How's it going to be decided about them?
Good question. Art, what do you think?
Yeah. Remember, I did mention nursing home workers, and I think we'll probably see hospice and home care drawn into that. Also, people who work in prison health care, for example, that's a hot spot too. So, again, it's how you broadly define healthcare worker. Everybody thinks, well, doctors and nurses who work on the front lines in ERs and ICUs, and then everybody else will start to line up. I think it's going to be a long time before everybody else lines up, because if you really take the broad definition, remember, including the laundry people and the security and the transporter and the ambulance people and all of that, you're talking tens of millions of people by the time you're done. And I don't think we're going to have initially, you know, more than that kind of a supply to allocate out, say, until the end of next year.
Thanks for the call, Becky. We're talking to Art Kaplan, professor of bioethics at New York University. We're looking at vaccines and who gets them first when they're developed and produced. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What ethical considerations do you think should be taken into account when the coronavirus vaccine is ready? Who should get priority? What goals should drive that priority setting? What questions do you have about how this stuff works? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation about who should get a hypothetical COVID-19 vaccine first and why. Art Kaplan is with us, professor of bioethics in the Division of Medical Ethics at New York University's Grossman School of Medicine, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you work in healthcare yourself? What is your take on vaccine distribution? Would you appreciate vaccine priority if you're on the front lines of this pandemic? Who should get a vaccine when it comes out first? What questions do you have? Join in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's bring on another caller now. Kathy is with us in Wauwatosa. Kathy, hi.
Hi. Hi, thank you. If this vaccine does indeed prove to be a two-shot protocol, how would they go about making sure that people follow up with the second shot and not feel that it's just fine to just have one shot instead of two of them?
Interesting question, Art.
Prayer. You're really hoping they come back. Now we have their records and we know, hopefully, you know, that they got the shot at a drugstore from a doctor, and we're going to email them and call them and say, you know, remember, you need the second shot. The first one's only a primer, so to speak. It's a real problem. We've seen it, by the way, with cervical cancer, the shots for that called HPV shots. They require three shots. Many, many young women don't come back for the second and third shot. It is a huge problem. And by the way, while I'm at it, let me point out one other problem, which we should lay on the table for callers to ponder. The studies that are being done now of these vaccine candidates, the first ones that are coming through, they're all on adults. They're not on kids. So where kids fit in to, if you will, access and going first isn't quite certain. Do you want to say worked in adults? Then we'll open it up to kids. Do you want to say worked in adults? Now let's study it in kids. So that's going to be a policy choice, too.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. We'll go now to Dave in Toma. Dave, hi.
Yeah, hi. I don't think there's going to be any problem with meeting out the shots. For starters, if we do it to military and medical people first, well, they're automatically in line to get their initial and their booster shots. And there's so many people that are afraid of being the first ones to get the shot. I don't think we're going to have a mass influx of people to get the shots.
Interesting, Dave. Thanks a lot for the call. Art, Dave worried that it'll be the other way around. People won't want to get the vaccine, at least maybe not in the early days.
I think that's a real danger, a real probability. Well, I shouldn't even say danger. It may be a real choice that some people make. They may say this vaccine got approved on incomplete data, partly due to the politics of what's going on out there with the president hoping before the election to announce at least that something's out there in the way of a vaccine. And a fair number of people don't like vaccines anyway. So if you add skepticism about incomplete data or speed going too fast to some degree of vaccine hesitancy, there may be significant numbers of people who say, you know what, I'll wait for the military. I'll wait for the healthcare workers. Let's see how it works for them. One other complication in addition to the kid issue. If you go first to take a vaccine, you're thinking, well, you know, it's approved and it's good. But let's say another one comes down the road 6 months later. That's better. You know, it's 70% effective or 90% effective or something, and it lasts longer. You probably can't take that because by taking the first vaccine, you may have made yourself open to an overreaction if you get another vaccine. I don't know that that's true. It's a danger. It's turned out to be true for some other vaccines like dengue vaccine. So there's something that the media hasn't commented on much. Being first may take you out of the pool for getting something that may be better later.
Thanks a lot for that call, Dave. I will go to Rob now, calling from Chicago. Rob, hi.
Hi. Quick question. If you have COVID, are you eligible to get a shot?
Probably not. You probably have antibodies in you if you did okay with it and survived. I think you've got natural immunity. The only reason you might want a shot is if that natural immunity wears off. And you've seen stuff in the media, stuff in the science literature, too, that says we're not quite sure how long the immunity holds. So that's what the problem is. I'm going to say probably not. But if, you got COVID and then it turned out you tested negative for immunity a year out, then, yeah, you probably would line up for a shot.
Thanks a lot for that call, Rob. We're talking to Art Kaplan, professor of bioethics at New York University, looking at COVID-19 vaccines, if and when they come out, how priorities are set of who gets them first, who wants to get them. You can still join in with your thoughts and questions at 800-642-1234. Let's talk about this at the international level, Art. If a company in one country gets the vaccine, do they share their results, their process with a company in other countries? Like, how quickly can this vaccine spread from country to country?
Well, let me answer that with first what I think will happen, and then we can talk about what maybe ought to happen. What will happen is I think many countries, the U.S. and China, for example, will want to vaccinate very broadly in their own country before they share. Both have said so, more or less, their political leadership. So that is including both the high-risk folks, but also trying to control the spread and, using a large volume of vaccine before they're going to give it to somebody else. Other countries, Australia, for example, also making vaccine, and I think they have a similar attitude, let's do ourselves and sort of protect ourselves first, and then we'll talk about sale or gift to other places. What should happen is you probably want to watch where the spread is biggest just to try and control reinfection from coming to other countries, meaning if there was a super hot spot, Iran or, make up any country you like, and it was Italy from a while back, and it was really pumping this virus all over the place, it might make sense to try and give it there first to tamp down the epidemic. But I'm going to tell you, I think nationalism is going to prevail for a long time.
Let's go to another caller now. Jeff is with us in Superior. Jeff, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm afraid that your guest would probably say that if a Democrat was president, everyone would be forced to take the vaccine. Because fortunately, the Republicans don't force anyone to take a vaccine. So the fact that we're getting a vaccine sooner than we normally would, I think that's a good thing. And I'm very proud of our president for doing that. And I think the Republicans have the right principles in store of based on liberty and freedom of the individual to take the vaccine. This isn't not just a moral decision. It's an economic decision. People are suffering and losing their jobs. Their livelihoods are at stake. We need a vaccine sooner than later.
Jeff, thanks for the call. Jeff, glad that the Trump White House is expediting, development of a vaccine, Art.
Mm-hmm. Well, I hope they can do it. I don't see it. I think it's impossible just for the reasons I've been outlining about how long it takes you to get data and then how long it takes you to make it and how long it takes you to ship it. I'm going to say it again. There's no way this vaccine's going in any large number of people's arms before next year. Doesn't matter what the president wishes. Doesn't matter what Joe Biden dreams of. Just doesn't matter. There are just stark realities of collecting data and then manufacturing and distributing that, hopeful talk doesn't do away with. Let me remind caller of one other thing. There are mandates in Republican states and red states and blue states for kids to get shots to go to school. And some have more ability to exempt on religious grounds or health grounds. Some don't permit it at all. You have to go unless you have a health excuse. So we do have mandates. But all that said, I think initially there's not going to be any discussion of mandates because we're not going to have enough vaccine to do it anyway. We'll be looking to people who are healthcare workers who will get it as part of their job. And that's true for the military. The military doesn't get to choose. The military has a mandate that they're not going to have discussions with you about whether you want to take a vaccine or not.
Thanks for the call, Jeff. We'll go to Tony now in Ashland. Tony, hi.
Hey, good afternoon. I agree with your guest. Number one, I am a Republican. Number two, I got to tell you guys, I worked in pharmaceuticals for 14 years, and it took us 3 to 4 years to safely get a vaccine or a product to the consumer. So anybody who's out there thinking this is going to happen before 1 November, they need to listen to your guest. This is just, it's not true. And I wish the government would stop putting out information to get people's hopes up. We have completely gapped this doggone COVID-19 thing. And as a retired military member, I'm going to tell you, this is embarrassing.
Tony, thanks. Thanks a lot for the call. We just have a minute or so left. Art, what do you think of what Tony had to say?
I agree with him. I just think there's a lot of rhetoric, false hope flying around, some from the president, some from industry. There's even been some pumping up of stocks by companies saying, you know, we're ready or we got promising data when it's very preliminary. You know, if you're going to put a vaccine out to use on 330 Americans or 330 million Americans or 8 billion people on the globe, you got to be sure it's safe. You got to be sure it works very well to have that kind of an investment and then to back off of your other protections. I don't think that's going to happen by November.
Tony, thanks for the call. And Art, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Hey, my pleasure.
Arthur Kaplan is a professor of bioethics in the Division of Medical Ethics at the New York University Grossman School of Medicine. He talked to us today about the ethics of deciding who gets top priority for a COVID-19 vaccine. Still time to share your thoughts over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Here's a sampling of what we heard. Dave writes that healthcare workers and the elderly should get the vaccine first. They're the most vulnerable. James writes that frontline hospital, respiratory clinic workers, and nursing home workers should be prioritized for the vaccine. Doses left over, James says, move on to teachers and public health workers. What do you think? Let us know on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up after the news, we'll talk to two campground hosts here in Wisconsin about what it's like to be a full-time camper in the middle of a pandemic. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. The UW system is expected to roll out a dashboard with COVID-19 testing data for all of its universities and branch campuses. Coming up, we'll look at the uptick in positive cases and UW-Madison's order that students limit their movements. First, camping got a late start this year after being closed down during Wisconsin's Safer at Home order and reopening in early June. With many people canceling other vacation plans or wanting to spend more time outdoors, camping became a great option. Our next two guests spent all or part of their summer taking care of campers and campgrounds in state parks. Jim Winkler was the campground host, along with his wife Joan, at Carroll Lake Campground in the Northern Highland American Legion State Forest this summer. Jim, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
And Dwayne Miller was a host with his wife Rosemary at Wyalusing State Park in August. Dwayne, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
First of all, Jim, can you talk about this role of a host at campgrounds? I wasn't familiar with this job.
Host is a volunteer position, and we basically are the go-between between the campers and whatever needs to be done. We clean campsites, we welcome people in, give them information if they need it, whatever we can do to make their camping experience a better experience is what we try to do. We try to get to know a little bit about the campers. Matter of fact, some of them have been become fairly close friends over the years, so. You know, like I said, a volunteer position. We do clean campsites and we get clean bathrooms, but not this year because of the COVID. But otherwise, we take care of that kind of stuff, too.
And Dwayne, it sounds fun. You get to camp at the park as long as you want in some ways. But from what Jim said, it sounds like it's a lot of work, right?
It is some work. Most of it you can get done within 2 to 3 hours. They figure about 15 hours a week, although it's more like, especially this year with more campers, it was more like 20 to 25 hours a week.
And Jim, you mentioned the bathroom. As Dwayne mentioned, a busier year. What looked different this summer with COVID-19 out there in camping than what you've seen in years past?
We had a lot more younger people, young couples, coming up camping for the very first time to northern Wisconsin, to our lake. They all loved it. Most of them just sat in their chairs and watched the water. We have quite a few sites right on the water. And a lot of kayaks, a lot of bikes, some skateboards. Not as many fishermen as normal, but a lot more of the other outdoor recreational things, which is great. They all had a great time and enjoyed and said they were all coming back. Our lake for the first time was reservations also, which made a difference because then the people from Madison, Milwaukee, Chicago knew they had a site when they got up there, which made it a little easier for them. Otherwise, sometimes you get up there and there's nothing available. So the reservation system did draw in a different crowd, basically.
And Dwayne, what did you see at Wyalusing?
It's more of a park for hiking and a beautiful bluff that we sit over, overlooking the Wisconsin and Mississippi rivers. So there were a lot of the same kind of things, a lot more younger people this year, a lot of filled campsites. It's been reservation there for most of the time, but people at least knew that they were coming in and that they could find a space for their family, enjoy the hiking, enjoy the trails. The boating and fishing were big this year. And again, like Jim said, a lot of kayaks this year.
And Dwayne, do you get a chance as a host in a normal year and or this year to, you know, meet some of the campers and get to know them and what brings them out?
This year especially, we got to meet more of the campers because the main house with the rangers was closed down due to the COVID restrictions. So more of the campers had to come to us to ask questions about hiking trails, about where to go and things to do in the neighborhood. So, yes, we got to talk to quite a few of them. And like Jim said, we got to be pretty friendly with a lot of people, and several of them even became good over this course of the year.
And Jim, did you end up doing a lot of that kind of the stuff that the rangers might ordinarily do too?
Yeah, our station was closed too, so we had to basically make sure we had the right people in the right campsites. And that happens most of the time, but once in a while there's a discrepancy. But so you get to talk to them a little bit, find out where they're from, and go from there. So, yeah, it was a good experience.
Talking to Jim Winkler and Dwayne Miller, they have both been hosts this summer at state campgrounds through a big chunk of the summer in this unusual COVID-19 year. Jim, the first-timers, did they get it, or did you have to – was there a little more letting people know what the rules were of life in a campground?
Most of them were pretty good. I think most of them had done their research because they – had their stuff on the phone and everything, so they basically knew. And a lot of them had camped when they were kids and hadn't done it for a number of years, and now we're coming up. We had one group of three ladies having the lady weekend, and about 2 weeks later, one of the ladies brought her whole family back up because they had such a good time. So, you know, there was a lot of that kind of stuff going on, which was always nice to see.
And Dwayne, were people pretty well behaved this year at Wyalusing?
They were very well behaved for the most part. Again, about the biggest issues we had were just with the first timers. They may have had some trouble with knowing up how to set up a tent or how to back their camper into the slots that we have. But all of them caught on pretty quickly. And, you know, I probably did a little more this year of having to go out to a site and help them back it up or help them set up their site and then welcome them to the camp and get going again.
Well, I want to ask each of you how you got into being a volunteer host. Dwayne, let's start with you on this one. What led you and your wife to take up this busy job?
Well, when I retired, I figured I wanted to do more volunteering. And since we live in Green Bay, I wanted to work for the Packers. So both dreams have come true, although this year not so much with the Packers. But I was looking for something to volunteer, and we've always enjoyed the state park system in Wisconsin, the beautiful parks. And so we thought this is a way to kind of give back to what we've enjoyed throughout the past years.
And Jim, what led you and your wife into being volunteer hosts?
Basically, same thing. When we retired, we had some time, and we thought it'd be nice to go up there and spend, you know, some considerable time camping. Carroll Lake, where we're on, I told somebody the other day, I've been fishing on that lake for about 65 years already. So it's pretty comfortable up there for me, and I knew the area, and I even worked one summer in the visitor center. Got paid for that one, but we just enjoy being up there and meeting the people and talking and having a good time.
Now, Dwayne, do you see yourself going to Wyalusing year after year, or do you mix it around and check out and work at different sites?
So far, it's just been Wyalusing that we've been at. We've talked about maybe, since it's only 1 month at a time there, we were there the month of August. We've considered maybe, because it's enjoyable, doing either like June or July or even September and October at another state park, just to continue camping and continue enjoying the outdoors.
And Jim, do you have your eyes on some other parks around the state?
We've worked at three different parks. All of them are in Northern Highland American Legion Forest, but usually we're up for at least two sessions and sometimes three sessions. The lake we're on right now does not have electricity, which deters some boats from showing up, because 5 weeks is a long time without electricity, but we make it do. So it works out good for us.
Now, I won't name names here. One of our producers just let me know that she and her mom got scolded for having a radio on while they were camping a few weeks back. Any advice for campers, especially those first timers, to make sure they're good neighbors, Dwayne?
Well, state parks are generally known for being a little quieter, a little more well-behaved than your private campgrounds. We want people to be having a good time celebrating whatever events they come, especially like there are birthday parties and family get-togethers and meetings. They just have to remember that as it starts getting toward 10 o'clock, there are some families, and they're in tents. So there are some families that are putting their children to bed at that time. And just to quiet things down, I did have to talk to a couple of people about just taking it inside. And, if they want to continue talking, just to go in their tents or into their campers and do it there where it's a little bit quieter and won't be bothering somebody who's putting their children asleep at that time.
Jim, if there's somebody out there listening thinking, hey, maybe this is me being a campground host, I just retired or whatever, what would you say to encourage them to give it a try?
I think it's a good experience. And again, you can apply online. I know they're always looking for hosts. One of them that had been doing it for a couple of years has told us this year that this is their last year they're going to do it. So, you know, there's always openings up in American Legion Forest anyway. And I'm sure there are in other parks also. So it's a good experience. We really enjoyed it. And we still are, plan on doing it for as many years as we can yet. But a lot of opportunities out there for people who want to give it a try.
Well, we'll leave it there, Jim. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Dwayne, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And thanks to both of them and their wives for helping take care of our parks. We've been talking to Jim Winkler, campground host, along with his wife Joan at Carroll Lake Campground in the Northern Highland American Legion State Forest this summer. And also with us, Dwayne Miller, host with his wife Rosemary at Wyalusing State Park in August this year. Coming up, we'll look at an uptick in positive COVID-19 cases on UW system campuses and find out how campuses are trying to deal with a weird fall. Find out more coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Tom Burgess's new book lifts the lid on the world's kleptocrats, who are now richer and more powerful than ever. Find out why on 1A+, today at 6, here on the Ideas Network. Now, the UW system is launching a dashboard to track COVID-19 cases at all of its universities and branch campuses. Most of the schools did not have a way to publicly report that kind of data. The dashboard comes a day after UW-Madison told students to restrict their movements for the next couple of weeks to address an uptick in cases on that campus. In a letter to students, faculty, and staff, Chancellor Rebecca Blank said, quote, "We've reached the point where we need to quickly flatten the curve of infection, or we will lose the opportunity to have campus open to students this semester, which we know many students truly want." Other universities in the state have also reported steep increases in the numbers of students and employees testing positive. And that all comes as the fall semester gets underway. Rich Kramer is a Wisconsin Public Radio reporter in Eau Claire. Rich, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, let's look at this dashboard concept first of all, Rich. A few campuses have their own already. This thing's going to be for all the campuses around the state, at least in the UW system.
That's right. Yeah, and I just looked while I was waiting to come on air, and it's not up yet. But I'm told that it's either going to be it'll be posted today, and the numbers may not be populated until tomorrow. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if there's a delay because the sheer number or sheer volume of data that they're trying to put in one spot is pretty daunting. I mean, the campuses themselves are they've got very different dashboards. The ones like UW-Milwaukee, Parkside, UW-Whitewater, UW-Platteville, UW-La Crosse, UW-Stevens Point, to name a few, have dashboards, but some are just reporting cumulative totals of positive cases. Some have more information like total number of tests, but it's all a little bit different. And I'm told that those will have to fit seamlessly with this system-wide dashboard. So I'll be very curious to look at it because it's a lot of work trying to keep tabs on what the latest numbers are at these, you know, and that's just at 13 universities. I'm talking about the UW system. The private colleges, the only one I've seen so far is Marquette University has a dashboard, but it's just a lot of hunting to find to get a fuller sense of what's going on in higher education in the state.
Now, one school that's one campus that's had a dashboard for this COVID information is UW-Madison. What have we seen when it comes to COVID testing at the state's biggest campus?
A significant increase in the number of positives, like over the past week. Excuse me. So students moved in. They started moving in like the last week of August. And since then, UW-Madison said that they were going to do a huge testing surge, try to do around 8,000 tests in their first week. And they said there would be an increase in positives because of that as students are moving in, et cetera. But the surge has really gone beyond that. And UW-Madison has indicated that it's not just increased testing that's resulting in the higher. The most telling trend is the 7-day positive percentage. And right now, UW-Madison is looking at a positive percentage of something like just under 6% overall. And it started at 1.2% when they first put out data. So that's been on the rise ever since. There was an anomaly with the data that came out today. There was a 22.5% percentage positive rate for UW-Madison, but that's because the number of students tested was like 93 and that 21 of them tested positive. But the day before there was almost 1900 tests reported. So it's kind of apples and oranges, but still the 7-day rate has been steadily increasing, and there that's been tied to social gatherings off campus. But you know, that's not the only reason.
Now, there's some thoughts that, college students, they're younger, they're likely to be in lower risk groups. They're low risk, but not no risk. But you also talked to Dr. Nasya Safdar, infectious disease specialist from UW Health, about the low hospitalization rate for college students. Here's some of what she had to say.
We will tend to see what happens in the community. And eventually, if rates continue as they are, then the infection will start to move into the age group where people will need to seek health care if they get COVID. And so we worry about that.
Is there a lot of talk, Rich, on campuses about that idea of community spread? It could, if students are spreading it, it could go to higher risk groups, either on campus or in the local community?
Well, on campus, it's mostly, at least UW-Madison, it's mostly been focused on just the sheer number of cases that have been coming up. A lot of students feel like that was inevitable. And they a lot of students I've talked to feel it's inevitable that classes will go online eventually. But what I saw from Public Health Madison-Dane County today was a tweet that in the past week, the department has seen 901 new COVID cases in Dane County overall. And 71% of that is tied to students or staff at UW-Madison. So what happens on campus greatly impacts what happens off campus. I mean, just strictly from a math perspective, but also those students are interacting with clerks at stores, you know, it's just person-to-person contact happens, especially when you've got, you know, 30, 40,000 students coming to town.
Talking to WPR reporter Rich Kramer about how UW system campuses and others are dealing with COVID-19. And let's hit this announcement yesterday from UW-Madison Chancellor Rebecca Blank. What is this sort of lockdown going to look like?
Yeah, I'm calling it a soft lockdown today. That's trademarked. But in general, it is you're telling undergraduates. So this is only for, you know, people, for the students that are freshmen to seniors. And it's not for employees. It's not for grad students. It's not for researchers. But in general, they're told to stay in their dorms or apartments unless they are purchasing food, going to a religious service, you know, going to an in-person class, which there are still those, and or engaging in some outdoor activity where you're essentially by yourself. Other than that, they're basically being told to hunker down. And this comes after all kinds of social media chatter, pictures, videos of very busy establishments down State Street where a lot of the students like to go and let loose. And so, you know, for a feature that I recently did, I talked with a health psychologist and they told me that it's not terribly realistic to expect 100% compliance out of a student body when you're looking at people in this age group. And part of that, she said, was because, you know, the human brain doesn't stop developing until your late 20s, and especially the parts that, you know, kind of balance the complex risk assessment situation with just emotional drive and social connections. So this person told me that students aren't really wired, especially younger students, to do these things that they're being asked to do. So it's really a complex situation.
We hear in this announcement from Chancellor Blank, though, if students aren't able and willing to do that, if numbers keep going up, she seemed to hold out the concept that they might follow the Notre Dames and North Carolinas of the world and have to close down the campus. Is that something people are talking about openly at this point in administrations, Rich?
Well, this is about as close as I've seen it be discussed openly. Chancellor Blank, she really says that this is kind of the last effort to keep classes, at least some in-person experience on campus, going. And actually, Nasia Safdar from UW Health said the same thing. She said that this sort of a lockdown is really the last option. She said after that, there's not many other options other than, you know, shutting it down. So, and again, some students, faculty, and staff have felt like that's inevitable, and that some have said that the university shouldn't have even tried in person. But on the other hand, as you mentioned in the intro, a lot of students, and when I talked to freshmen at UW-Eau Claire moving into the dorms there, they and their parents were very excited for that in-person experience, because that's a big part. It's not just studying, obviously. You're building social connections that can last a lifetime, and it's really helping you transform. So it's a mix of people really hoping that they can stick it out, but there's also a lot of cynicism and skepticism that it can actually happen.
Rich, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
Thank you, Rob.
Rich Kramer is a Wisconsin Public Radio reporter in Eau Claire. We talked to him about the uptick in COVID-19 cases on UW system campuses, as well as UW-Madison's order that students limit their movements for the next 2 weeks. And we took a look at how campuses are sharing COVID-19 data publicly. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, it's our weekly look at some of the top stories in national politics, including questions in Congress about the Postmaster General and his company's political donations before he was appointed to the federal post. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. A couple of weeks back here on Central Time, we talked about a big hobby during the pandemic, sewing. A lot of people have gotten into it or back into it. On a related note, quilters have been busy lately, and they've made a big difference for a project here in Wisconsin. As reported in the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, the Wisconsin Museum of Quilts and Fiber Arts in Cedarburg put out a call on social media for people to create mini quilts, 1 square foot, that could then be stitched together to create a bigger mosaic. It was a way to have people work together on a project, even if they couldn't get together to do it in person. Museum staff thought they'd get maybe 10 or so of these quilts. Instead, they got 500, more than 500 now, actually. A lot of them came from Wisconsin or nearby, but some as far away as Netherlands, Israel, and the UK. The quilts were thematic, many in honor of healthcare workers or with uplifting messages in a tough time. So what do you do with 500 plus square feet of quilt squares? You make some quilts. Museum staff have put them together into 27 mosaics so far that could go up as they're still accepting submissions. And a Milwaukee artist turned 49 of the mini quilts into a giant mask. You can see the quarantine quilt exhibit in Cedarburg until November 15th at the Wisconsin Museum of Quilts and Fiber Arts. More info and some images at wiquiltmuseum.com. And you can hear more about the project. The curator joined the Larry Mueller Show last week, Monday. Check out our archives at wpr.org. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.